Welcome to Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Gregory Errolson, who is the president and publisher of Our Sunday Visitor Publishing Company. Our Sunday Visitor is one of the largest Catholic publishers in the world, publishing books, periodicals, curriculum, and pamphlets. Gregory has co-authored with Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Pope Benedict XVI and the Sexual Abuse Crisis, Working for Reform and Renewal. Since 1985, the Catholic Church in the United States has been living in the shadow of the clerical sexual abuse crisis. In 2002, revelations in Boston ignited an institutional nightmare. More recently, the scandal erupted in Ireland and spread across Europe. There is now a rush by some, both inside and outside the church, to place direct blame upon Pope Benedict XVI. Pope Benedict XVI and the sexual abuse crisis is a groundbreaking, critically objective assessment of the criticism facing the Pope, as well as review of his real response to the victims, abusers, bishops, media, and the millions of Catholics worldwide who continue to be justifiably horrified by the scandal. We're going inside the pages of Pope Benedict XVI and the sexual abuse crisis, Working for Reform and Renewal. We now begin part two of our discussion with Gregory Errolson, discussing recent media attacks on the character and leadership of Pope Benedict XVI in the secular media. This is not a new approach, unfortunately, attacking the Holy Father, whether he be, a good example would be how they attacked Pope Pius XII beginning in the 1960s, of course, after his death. And those allegations really surfaced in the 80s. That essentially became an attack on John Paul, even though it was in an indirect way. But now there, it's a full frontal assault on Pope Benedict.
Yes. Well, and Scripture talks about, striking the shepherd and the flock will scatter. That's clearly the case. Our Sunday Visitor published a book, a second edition of a book, just this year, called Hitler, the War, and the Pope by Ron Reichlach, which is an exhaustive historical study of the record of Pius XII and the allegations against him. But the irony is, and Pius XII is a good example of what I think people are trying to do with Pope Benedict, the facts almost become irrelevant. Mm-hmm. In the popular imagination now, Pius XII was somehow an ally with or accommodated Hitler. Mm-hmm. And while the historical record says exactly the opposite, it doesn't seem to matter. People are still writing op-ed opinions, and people are still speaking out on television, assuming that Pius XII is now a bad guy. Mm-hmm. And these people have no idea of what the record is. The same thing's happening with Benedict. And Pope John Paul, it was very hard to do that. He was so popular. I think you're seeing the attacks now. Some people are trying to sort of after the fact say that John Paul is also responsible for the sexual abuse crisis as well. But again, what is the point of all this? It's often a combination of stereotypes about how the church is structured so that the Pope is actually seen as some kind of all-powerful dictator, and also the idea that he is the embodiment of what the church teaching is. And so by attacking him, they're challenging really the credibility of the church as a whole. And I think that's behind a lot of this.
This is the real point. I mean, this is where Catholics, not only out of love for the Holy Father, but even if that's not present in the heart of a Catholic, it needs to be for the moral authority and the teaching authority of the church. Because if you can strike, as you said, the head of this particular, of the Catholic Church, then all the moral teachings begin to unflail. And that's, as you've said, all those agendas, whether it can't speak then about marriage, then you cannot speak about homosexuality, you cannot speak about life issues.
Exactly.
Because you have no moral high ground.
Exactly. In fact, you hear that now. I mean, what can the church say? Look at how they've allowed the abuse of children, So whatever the theme is that the church wants to speak out. Chris, while the subject of our book is Pope Benedict and the sexual abuse crisis, the real crisis facing the church is how well informed Catholics are about their own faith.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is the crisis that stretches across all the other mini crises, in a sense. How well do Catholics know the faith? How well do they know the Church? And that's the need that we have, is for Catholics to be informed. That's the value of Catholic radio. It's the value of Catholic print media. It's the value of Catholic books. It's the value of Catholic internet sites, is to the extent that they can inform Catholics about their own faith, so that the Catholics are not solely accepting what comes from the secular media, but can critique it from a position of knowledge. And that's really why we wrote the book. It's not a happy topic, and I can understand that many Catholics say, oh my gosh, we've heard enough of this, we don't need to hear more. But the truth is, they haven't heard the right things. They haven't heard what the Church has really been doing. It hasn't been put in context for them, and that's what we tried to do, to realize that this is not something where we have to simply hang our heads in shame and say, oh, the New York Times must be correct. Oh, the critics must be correct. The truth is, they're half right. Some of those bad things did happen, but the Church has responded. The problem is, Catholics aren't informing themselves about these things, and that's the real danger. How well do Catholics know the truth about their own Church? If Catholics are well informed, these other things really won't impact us. We'll have responses for them. But my fear is, and statistics bear this out, is that Catholics draw most of their knowledge about the Church from the secular media. And their religious education generally has stopped somewhere around eighth grade. So the combination of those two factors is a terrible thing. And the modern world of communications is so dominating that if Catholics are relying on an eighth grade knowledge of their own faith and what they pick up in their local paper, then unfortunately they're doomed. And I think that our mission is really to resist that.
I think you're absolutely right, and you hit on the point that we have to defend the faith, but not necessarily first and foremost from outside attacks or from our family members, but from our own doubts.
Yes.
And that's where we need to be informed. That's why this is, in essence, so important. As you were speaking, I was recalling, believe it or not, that battle in the Civil War where they needed to hold Little Round Top. I mean, this little band of people against this great onslaught, but they needed to save that hill. Otherwise, the battle in Gettysburg would have been lost.
Yes, we have another example of that, and we haven't seen the end of it yet, but the Chilean miners. And realizing that in a situation like that, they have a choice. This can be a heroic event that could conceivably change the course of their country and certainly have a huge impact on people, or it could be Lord of the Flies. If they don't band together, if they don't work together, then it can all fall apart. And I think what's troubling many people is that the Church can be so riven by dissension and doubt and ideology at this point, so that are we really, you know, that song that probably drove some of us crazy but had a good message, you know, they'll know we are Christians by our love.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that they're knowing, the outside world is seeing that that much these days. We're spending a lot of time beating up on each other, and that unfortunately weakens our whole witness to the world. And if this event, this crisis, sexual abuse crisis, becomes another way to divide Catholics and to fragment us and to force us to hide our light under a bushel, then that's a really bad thing.
Greg, in the appendix of the book, you cover a number of different topics, very important, especially the perspective of canon law. That's an important factor in the response that the United States Church has had, along with even the Church in England, in how it's responded to this horrific scandal.
I think the canon law section of the book, I actually think, is alone worth acquiring it. It was written by Monsignor William King, and he's a canonist that we know, who I think had a very good perspective and a very clear writing style in approaching this. And the essence of it is, I mean, there's a lot of details here, and Catholics themselves, and certainly non-Catholics, don't understand the role of canon law. But I mean, canon law is the law of the Church, and it's not meant to supersede secular law. Mm-hmm. It's simply the law by which the church governs itself. And what's important to realize is that the church has always banned the abuse of minors, particularly by clergy, and it has a series of rules regarding that. And so what Monsignor King does is simply he walks through canon law, you know, what its aim is, which is always to change the behavior first and foremost, and stating what some of the penalties of the church are. And so this section, which is not many pages, it's relatively short, mm-hmm. but I think it gives a great background for Catholics to understand, for example, what's involved with the laicization of a priest, for example, removing a priest from the clerical state. That's the secular media calls it defrocking, but defrocking really isn't a canonical term. But you know, how is the role of the priest understood, and the idea that holy orders is a permanent mark, and at the same time, people who have done things so heinous that they have to be removed. So it's a great little essay, and I think it'd be very useful for folks to read that, to just get an understanding of what the church is really saying here.
I think that it brings up the point in the hearts of many Catholic faithful when they hear that. Then their response is, then why would the bishops allow this to be that essence of being covered up in their diocese? Yes. And when this stuff came forward, how did that happen?
Well, I think that has to be broken down into a couple different areas. I think first is that the bishops, remembering that a lot of these events that people are documenting are 30, 40, 50 years old. So what happened in the 20th century that became a game changer in many ways was the advent of psychology and psychiatry. Mm-hmm. And so people looked on this at a certain point. This kind of deviant behavior became a clinical problem, more so than a moral problem. So sometimes it was viewed, you know, early on as simply a moral problem. Okay, Father so-and-so has done something wrong. He has to go to confession, was basically it. Mm-hmm. And then that combines with, okay, he needs therapy. And therapists who really are getting away scot-free on this whole controversy were giving advice that, okay, these men are overstressed. Maybe they have a drinking problem. Maybe they're working too hard. They came up with a variety of things. And so as long as they're getting treatment, we can treat this issue. In some cases, we can medicate this issue, and it's not going to happen again. The bishops were thinking that they were responding in a pastoral way to this trauma that was happening within, you know, their own presbyterate, within their clergy. What got ignored there was that not only is this a personal failing on the part of the priest, but it is violating canon law, and it needed to be dealt with directly. Now, canon law was revised and finally promulgated. The new canon law that the church operates under today was in 1983. Mm-hmm. So there's a long period of revision and rewriting that corresponded with this. And I think, truthfully, a lot of people didn't know what was binding and what was not binding. The 2001 norms that I talked about earlier was really a clarifying that what once had been the case was still the case, that every incidence of alleged clergy sexual abuse that had any sort of foundation to it had to go to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. But for a long time, that was in doubt. And so the bishops felt, well, it was their responsibility to resolve it on their own, and that was handled in a variety of ways. And what was at the time perhaps viewed as a pastoral approach, in retrospect, was a disaster. But this was a combination of lots of many experts giving advice and completely messing everything up. And to even make it more complicated, then you had lawyers who said, well, you can't admit anything because mm-hmm. of all the legal liability issues. So the bishops were being pulled in a variety of different directions, and I think everybody kind of lost sight of some of the essential elements of it, of what a grievous sin this was, and what a violation of canon law was, and that it had to be addressed in a more formal way and not just simply in a kind of a half-baked pastoral way.
And I think it needs to be said as well that there again, was not necessarily a collective reaction by the bishops. There were some bishops who were staunch advocates of what yes. had always been, that which they perceived as the response of the church through canon law to deal with this. The problem arose where there were those bishops who did not take that approach. I'm trying yes. to be very delicate here.
No, you're absolutely right, and I have a good example for you in that. You had Cardinal Law and how he responded in Boston, and then you had one of his auxiliary bishops who actually wrote to him in a particular instance and said, "We got a problem here," Bishop John Darcy, and Bishop John Darcy then became head of the Fort Wayne South Bend Diocese and actually was the chairman of our board of directors for our Sunday visitor. And Bishop Darcy was very forthright in addressing this issue, both to the extent that he could in Boston and then also in Fort Wayne South Bend. And you can look around the country and you can see dioceses where they've had very few lawsuits and very few problems because the issues were dealt with pretty directly with the means that were available to them. And then you see other places that were just terrible. You know, this, in the long run, this shows that, you know, we're not dealing with a centralized cover-up of any sort.
Mm-hmm.
And there was all different sorts of reasons for why the bishops were responding the way they did. I think one of the most complicated reasons, and the ones that is probably most mocked outside of the church, is the fact that there is theologically understood to be a filial relationship between the bishop and his priest. It's a father-son relationship. And so imagine, any listener now, imagining what it would be like if someone in your family, someone you are close to, was an abuser.
Mm-hmm.
And how would you respond to that? Even some of the church's harshest critics have had to deal with this. What would you do in that case if you had an abuser in your family? And anyone with any degree of honesty would have to say that they would just be torn apart by that, and they would respond in all sorts of ways that they couldn't even predict.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the bishops in many cases felt violated almost as a family member. And the problem with that, in retrospect, is not that certainly the filial concern has to be there, but there's another relationship that has to be appreciated, which is the fact that a young person, a child, a teenager, was their trust was violated and abused as well, and their family was impacted. And I think in those terrible cases where not enough was done, it's clear that the thought wasn't given to the implications to that child and to the child's family. But there were lots of good bishops out there who did respond appropriately, and that also has been lost in all of this coverage.
I think that the subtitle for the book is an imperative to bring forward right now. It's Pope Benedict XVI and the Sexual Abuse Crisis, Working for Reform and Renewal. There is a light at the end of this tunnel. We just cannot get caught up in the darkness that's trying to engulf it.
That's right. I think that is one message that the book hopefully draws the reader towards, and certainly what I think Pope Benedict is trying to do. If we feel apart from all of this and we just think, you know, the same way we think about people in Washington, oh, those crazy people in Washington, oh, those crazy people at the Vatican, those crazy people in the Chancery, and we just feel this kind of discontent and helplessness over it, we're not going to resolve this issue. I think what we have to see is that we have a role in this, each one of us, in the reform and the renewal of the church. And the Pope is laying out steps for this. He's actually, in his letter to the Catholics of Ireland, he encourages Eucharistic adoration. He encourages a turning back to the sacraments, deepening in the faith, daily prayer, reading Scripture, praying for the forgiveness of those who have sinned so terribly, and asking the Spirit to come down and help the church during this time of great need. All of those are things that we can do, whether we're homebound or we're at our desk or we're a child in school. All of those things we can get engaged in. And I think that's really important for us to remember, that as Catholics, is that we are empowered to do something about all of this. And the Pope is challenging us to do that.
If I may ask, Greg, as you're watching the Holy Father now venture into England, What are your thoughts?
Well, you're right. This is an amazing event, and the English have been certainly kicking up a lot of dust on this one. All the struggles of the Reformation, it seems like, are suddenly there. But there's a lot more going on as well. There's all various forms of opposition to the church, and some of it is not. In fact, the presence of the Anglican Church in England is at an all-time low. So less of it is Christian versus Christian, and more of it is modernity versus the church, and this kind of atheistic outlook or secularist outlook versus the witness of the Pope. And that will be one of the dramas that's going to be playing out here. You know, this is, in some ways, in terms of how people are living their lives, it's the gospel of Christopher Hitchens has probably won the day in much of England. And people are practical atheists, if not literal atheists. They're living their lives according to very material standards. Church attendance is very low. Church practice of any sort is low. Marriages within the church is low. So all this has been building in England for some time. Now here comes the Pope, and he's the embodiment of what many of the English seem to have just stopped thinking about. And then you layer on the sexual abuse crisis as well, and so you have that whiff of controversy to go along with it. So you have people saying that the Pope should be arrested and prosecuted when he comes there. Mm-hmm. There's going to be all sorts of demonstrations against him. There's going to be all sorts of things on television sort of re-examining the controversy. If you remember when Benedict was coming to the United States, there was a huge wave of criticism in advance of that visit. The same thing happened when Pope John Paul came to World Youth Day in Denver in 1994. Mm-hmm. I remember all the media coverage was so negative. The Pope's out of touch. And then when the Pope comes, in both cases, John Paul in Denver and Benedict in the United States, what an incredible impact. And even the media had to acknowledge that he had an engaging message and that people were resonating with them. And my guess is that in England, we're going to see the same thing, that there will be, of course, the critics, and the critics have been having a field day. But I think when people see the crowds and when people see the devotion that the Pope is attracting, and when they hear his message, and it will be an honest and forthright and courageous message, I think, addressing the English people where they are, I think we're going to see quite different coverage by the end of the visit. And I hope I'm right, but I really do believe that will be how this will unfold.
I share the same hope as you, because I think the word fearlessness is not correct, I don't think. I think it's more courageous. Maybe it's from that supernatural virtue that is instilled on us, that he has grown inside of him, that he can go to these places with love and joy and reach out. If we could do the same thing interiorly as he does, then why can't we do that with our neighbors, our coworkers, and those around us?
Yes. I think the witness, both with, you know, there are two amazing popes, really, that we've been able to experience, John Paul II and Pope Benedict, very different in some ways, very similar in others. Both, you know, the last popes who will be personally so shaped by Vatican II, and the way they've understood it, and the way they've allowed the spirit of that council to fill their lives. Pope John Paul, I remember how he engaged popular culture. He had absolutely no fear. He felt that the church had something to give to the culture, and yet at the same time he was willing to listen to representatives of that culture, whether it was singers or songwriters or actors or novelists or whoever. He was willing to engage them. I think Pope Benedict is in some ways more a true intellectual and academic, but he engages just as bravely with the culture, and his focus on Europe that I think is also going to be a hallmark of this pontificate is, you know, in a land that was traditionally Christian and Catholic and now has become so de-Christianized, this is where he sees the battle. This is where he thinks that the struggle should be waged. And he's embarking on that without any fear or hesitation. And you're right. We have to learn from that and find ways to, in a sense, follow his leadership, even if it's in our local community or our local school or local parish or wherever. But it is remarkable, and I think we are seeing, I think we're really seeing a great pontificate unfolding before our eyes.
I do too. I think one of the things that can really help us again is the work that you've done with Matthew Bunsen on Pope Benedict XVI and the sexual abuse crisis, working for reform and renewal. It is the perfect layout of a book. It gives us the information, the background, but then also the resources and what we need so that we can go forth and be better educated, not only for our own hearts, but to be able to be a light to others. And Greg, I just appreciate so much the extra time that you've taken with us today in this interview. And do you have any final thoughts before we close?
Well, I think that it's been great talking with you, and I hope that people, even if they are as much repelled by this crisis as unfortunately forced to listen to it, that they will find this book of use. And one of the things that I find most interesting is I've received letters and comments from people who have had abuse in their family, and even family members, sons or brothers who have been abused by priests, who have written to me and said how useful this book was for them in helping them to heal and helping them to understand within a broader context. So I think that in some ways those letters and that feedback I treasure more than anything, because I realize that they don't feel that it's a whitewash, and they don't feel that we're simply trying to explain away or diminish the problem, but at the same time we really are providing the context that I think Catholics need to understand this crisis and to move on.
It's such an important work, and I know that our Sunday Visitor will continue to take a lead in helping to do that, not only through this work and its other books, but also through the News Weekly.
Yes, and thank you for mentioning that. And the News Weekly is, of course, providing this. I know people say reading newspapers is passé, but I think there's a great tool there to keep Catholics informed, just as we were talking about earlier. And it's getting better all the time, so I hope that people will pick it up and look at it.
Gregory Arelson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
We've been going inside the pages of Pope Benedict XVI and the Sexual Abuse Crisis, Working for Reform and Renewal with Gregory Arelson. To obtain a copy of this book, go to www.osv.com, the website for Our Sunday Visitor, or any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and download both parts 1 and 2 of our discussion with Gregory Arelson, along with many other interviews, go to www.insidethepages.com. I'm Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.